This week on Making Contact.
When I saw the human face of the people in the war, when I met my so-called enemies, I found that I had no hatred and no desire to fight them. So I went to my commander, I turned in my assault rifle, and I said, "Look, I'll stay, but I'm not going to fight. I'm not going to kill. I think killing is wrong, and this war is wrong."
With the U.S. occupation of Iraq in the middle of its third year, a small but growing number of Iraq War veterans are refusing to continue their military service. They're risking jail time, dishonorable discharge, and public humiliation to take a stand against the war. On this edition, produced by correspondent Sarah Olson, we'll hear from a handful of these soldiers about how their personal experiences transformed their convictions about war. I'm Justin Beck, your host this week on Making Contact, a program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information.
Well, my name is Sergeant Kevin M. Benderman, and I am a 63 Mike Bradley mechanic in the United States Army. I currently hold the rank of sergeant, and my job in the military is to make sure that the Bradley fighting vehicles are in a ready state of repair for combat operations.
Kevin Benderman was born in Alabama and raised in Tennessee. His family has a history of military service dating back to the Revolutionary War. After Benderman was honorably discharged from the Army in 1991, he re-enlisted 9 years later and completed boot camp for a second time at the age of 35. With nearly a decade of military service behind him, Benderman had his first combat experience in the invasion of Iraq in 2003. What he saw in combat ultimately led him to file as a conscientious objector.
All war is basically the same thing and is designed to kill as many people as possible. And that is the insanity that we need to get away from in this day and age. And some of the things that really let me know is how you got these young men and women that serve in the military and how it dehumanizes them. You know, you have to be able to kill. You have to become a killer. Put all your emotions and everything aside and go out there and kill. I mean, that's your job, period. And that's not right. I mean, we should not be pounding this into 18-year-old young people's heads. That's insanity in itself, you know. And a lot of them don't even have a full idea of just what they're going to, you know, because there was one guy that was my driver, and he had brought a video camera from home. And when the stuff was exploding all around us and, you know, stuff was coming at us, he wanted to stand up and videotape it.
Benderman says most of the people in the military are well-intentioned and hardworking. They're just stuck in a crazy situation. But he also worries that the pressure of battle makes otherwise rational people do irrational things, like when his unit was ordered to shoot at Iraqi children.
6, 7, 8-year-old kids. They had never seen tanks in the American Army, and so they were naturally curious, and they were just being kids. You know, they'd get up on the wall and look, and we would tell them to get down because we were going to secure the thing with what they call a concertina wire. But before we had a chance to do that, they were naturally climbing up there, looking and pointing and laughing. And, you know, well, a couple of them would throw a little rocks, and we'd tell them to get off the wall and go away, and they would. But, you know, they'd come right back 20 or 30 minutes later. And the captain was standing out there listening to us, telling them to get off the wall. And he came out and said, "If they get back up on that wall, you shoot them." And he turned around and went back in the building. And I mean, I think he was probably just scared. I'm not really sure where that came from, but he said it. And we all looked at him like he had lost his mind.
Sergeant Benderman's conscientious objector application was denied. He's facing a court-martial for refusing to go back to Iraq. If convicted, he could spend up to 7 years in prison. At the time this program was produced, the date for his court-martial had not been set. Camilo Mejia is an Army Staff Sergeant and a veteran of the Iraq War. He has already spent 9 months in prison for his refusal to go to war a second time. Mejia says that while U.S. troops were indeed welcomed shortly after the invasion, their long stay and harsh tactics led quickly to hostility from Iraqi civilians. There were a number of incidents that Mejia says convinced him to choose prison over going back to the war.
One time, we conducted this mission by a mosque. We had been told that we're not to conduct missions next to mosques or in schools or next to hospitals. But this one time, we were doing everything different. You know, we did this, we set up this traffic control point by a mosque, the biggest mosque in Ramadi. We were searching people, and then they didn't have anything, and we kept them there. And soldiers from my unit, you know, a few of them were designated to be drivers. So they would drive the car and park it, you know, kind of like a valet parking service. And they were parking these civilian vehicles and keeping the civilians in one place, even though they didn't have anything. You know, not detaining them because they did something wrong, but just detaining them, I don't know why. And we did this for like about an hour and a half by a mosque. And we were exposing all these civilians, and we got attacked. One soldier got shot in the leg, and then another one got shot in the vest, so nothing happened to him. And all the insurgents got away, and seven civilians were killed. Seven civilians who had been caught in the middle. They had no weapons, they had nothing to do with a firefighter or anything. And this is a pattern, you know, this is something that we start seeing over and over, you know. Overall, my platoon killed about 30 people. The time that we were there, the time that I was there, which was 5 months in Iraq. And of those 30 people, only three had weapons. So you're looking at about 90% of the people who we're killing to be innocent civilians.
Camilo Mejia lived in Central America for most of his life. In the 1980s, his father wrote the official anthem of the Nicaraguan Revolution. His mother ran a Costa Rican safe house for Sandinistas. When his family moved to New York, he went to night school and got a job at Burger King. A lot of people wonder how a person with Mejia's revolutionary background could end up in the U.S. military. He describes it very simply as an existential crisis. Mejia was deployed to the Middle East in early 2003.
The first time that I fired my weapon, we were at the mayor's office in Ramadi, and there was this political protest. They were protesting the occupation. But because of this protest turning violent, you know, they ordered my squad to take a defensive position on the rooftop. And then we were given the order to fire upon anybody who threw a grenade. And you could tell when they were going to throw a grenade because the whole crowd would move as one to a corner. And then everybody would get quiet. And then you would see somebody emerge. Or you would just see like the grenade flying up in the air and then boom. You know, at one point it got really quiet and then people moved to one area, and then out of this corner emerged a young man, really young, perhaps still a teenager, and he had something in his hand, and he was swinging it, and as he was going to throw it, we opened fire on him. And there's a blank spot in that memory. You know, I don't remember hitting him. You know, I remember him swinging his arm, and the next image I have is the image of people dragging him by the shoulders through a puddle of his own blood. And that image haunted me for a while. And I asked myself, why are you so bothered by this? Because, you know, you were ordered to do this, and he obviously threw a grenade, and this is a hostile action. And, you know, first of all, he was too far away, so his grenade couldn't have hurt anybody. Second of all, this was a protest, you know, well-founded, his country, you know, his land, protesting a foreign invader. I see this young man full of life, and then the next moment, you know, after I squeeze my trigger, you know, he's down and he's dead, and his blood is everywhere. And I don't think it's a justified killing. And I always wonder, you know, whether I hit him in the knee maybe, or in the leg, or in the chest. I always wonder if I, in fact, killed him, or if I just contributed to his death, or if I just completely missed. And it's something that's bothered me, you know, ever since that moment. You know, it was the first encounter I had with the power that we have as soldiers, and with the power of destruction that we carry as soldiers, and the impact that it has, you know, when you squeeze that trigger, you know, when you follow that illegal order, when you follow that immoral order, you know, it changes you.
While Mejia became increasingly opposed to the war, his deep sense of loyalty to his unit kept him silent until he returned to the U.S. He still feels responsible not only for the men he served with, but also for all U.S. forces in Iraq. Mejia hopes that other soldiers who may be thinking about speaking against the war will do so. He also wants to expose crimes committed against Iraqis by U.S. troops. For example, he says Abu Ghraib prison is not the only place where prisoners are tortured.
When we went to Iraq, the first mission that we had was a POW camp, a prisoner of war camp. And it was in this place called Al-Asad, which is part of the Baghdad International Airport complex. And it was being really ran by three, what in the military are known as spooks, three spooks. And a spook is somebody that nobody knows where they come from or where they go, what their real name is. And they go by fake names. I guess these guys' names were like Scooter, Artie, and Rabbit. So those were their names, and they were in charge. And we relieve this unit, and they tell us, okay, the spooks will tell you who are combatants and who are non-combatants, and these are the combatants right here. And they were separated by concertina wire, which is like real sharp, razor-sharp wire. And they were hooded and they were tied. And they said, well, these are supposed to be kept on sleep deprivation. You know, you got to soften them up for interrogation by the spooks. And the way you do that, you know, you yell at them, you know, you get on their face. Don't worry about them seeing you because they have a hood in their face. And you tell them to get up and get down and turn around or whatever. And you just yell at them. They'll get the message, you know, when you do it enough and often enough and loud enough, they'll understand what you're saying, even though I don't speak English, just by yelling and mistreating them. And if that doesn't work, then, you know, you grab this huge sledgehammer and you hit the wall next to them, and it'll make this explosive-like sound, and it'll scare them, and they'll do whatever you tell them to do. And if that doesn't work, then you grab this 90mm pistol and you charge it next to their head so as to perform a mock execution, and they'll do whatever you tell them to do. And this is like the first mission that we have in Iraq. So my opposition to the war becomes more personal, because it's not something I'm reading on the news, it's not something I'm watching on TV, but something I'm actually doing as a soldier in Iraq, you know, treating or actually mistreating and abusing these human beings.
Since he was released from prison in February, Mejia has been traveling around the U.S., speaking against the war in high schools, colleges, and anywhere else where people will listen. He tells young people who are considering enlistment that it was only after he put down his rifle that he regained his humanity.
We'll hear from more veterans of the Iraq War in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org.
Aiden Delgado is the 23-year-old son of a U.S. diplomat. Because he had grown up in the Middle East, Delgado says going to Iraq was a lot like going home. He was honorably discharged from the Army as a conscientious objector in April 2004. Since then, he has been traveling around the country presenting a slideshow of his experiences in Iraq.
When I saw the human face of the people in the war, when I met my so-called enemies, I found that I had no hatred and no desire to fight them. I looked at these guys and I said, these are young, poor, uneducated guys who didn't have any choices in their life. And I looked at the guys in my unit and I said, man, we're exactly the same. Most of the guys in my unit were young, poor, didn't have the best education, didn't have the best choices at home. And when I came to that conclusion, I felt all my sort of like fighting spirit just bleed out of me. I had no more reason to hurt them and no more reason to participate. So I went to my commander, I turned in my assault rifle, and I said, look, I'll stay, finish my job as a mechanic, I'll do everything you tell me to, but I'm not going to fight, and I'm not going to kill. I think killing is wrong, and this war is wrong.
After Delgado filed as a conscientious objector, the Army took away his personal body armor and denied him home leave. Later, he worked as a guard at Abu Ghraib prison beginning in November of 2003.
One incident I always talk about when they ask about the relation of guards and prisoners at Abu Ghraib was on one occasion, a prisoner had smuggled in a 9mm handgun and shot one of the guards in the chest. The guard had been wearing his hard ballistic plate, so the bullet didn't penetrate and he survived. In retaliation, the guard shot that prisoner in the legs with a shotgun and snapped his leg at the knee. They then took him to the hospital for treatment. Two MP guards dragged him on the shattered mass of his legs, threw him in the back of an Army deuce and a half truck. This was a big guy, he was like 350 pounds. And they made him kneel on his two broken legs in his underwear in 25 degree weather and high wind for an hour long ride to the Baghdad hospital. And my sergeant, who was on that detail, remembers wondering aloud whether the prisoner would die of hypothermia before he ever reached the hospital and from kneeling on his two broken legs. So that's always what I point to when people ask me how the guards and the prisoners interacted.
Delgado says it's easy to judge troops who commit acts of brutality and torture in Iraq, but that every American citizen bears some responsibility for such crimes. He also says it's impossible to predict how the stress of combat and the fear of death will change a person.
In late November, the prisoners had been demonstrating for several nights in a row against their living conditions. They'd torn up their tents and had been marching around with banners and slogans. Basically, they were protesting the cold weather and their lack of cold weather clothing, the rancid food which was giving them dysentery, and not being allowed to smoke. On the afternoon of the 24th, this demonstration became very unruly. The prisoners picked up stones and pieces of wood from the tent floor and started throwing them at the guards. They hit a buddy of mine in the face and kind of bloodied his nose. The military first tried to quell it with non-lethal rounds, and after they ran out, they asked for permission to use lethal force, and they got it. They opened fire on the prisoner with machine guns. They shot 12 of them. Three died immediately. One died later of his wounds. And I know this because one of the guys in my unit did the shooting, did the killing. And he came back and was telling me, and he was bragging about it. He was like, I shot this one in the head, and his head split open like in the Terminator. And I shot this one in the groin, and he bled to death 3 days later. And I got kind of upset. He was superior in rank, so there wasn't a lot I could say to him. I kind of lost it, and I said, are you really proud of this? You shot unarmed men behind barbed wire for throwing stones. And he didn't get mad at all. He was very calm. He said, look, I saw them bloody my soldier's face, so I knelt down, said a prayer, loaded my weapon, stood up, shot them down. And this was not a monster. This was the nicest guy you would ever want to meet. He was very polite, courteous, he was a devout Christian, a family man.
Goodrich grew up in Buffalo, New York. He had always wanted to join the Air Force. His family had a history of military service, and he was proud of his country. While serving in Afghanistan as part of Operation Enduring Freedom, he wrote messages on bombs. Dear Osama bin Laden, have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
When I was over helping with the missions over Iraq, I never had any questions. Same with Afghanistan. I never had any questions about what we were doing, because it was all very clean, because you don't see the human side of things. For example, when I saw that intelligence debriefing that they showed us where the bomb was hitting its target, of course you couldn't see any people on the ground. It's not the same as holding a rifle and shooting somebody that's 100 feet away. So as far as you know, when that bomb hits its target, you don't think of the people on the ground. You don't think that there's anybody around. You don't think of their family that's being hurt because of that, because their father was killed. And I didn't question anything until this war in Iraq.
Months before the Bush administration announced to the American public its intention to invade Iraq, Goodrich had seen the early warning signs. He knew this meant he could have to stay in the Air Force even after his commitments had been fulfilled. He began questioning the Bush administration's official reasons for the invasion.
I realized that any war with Iraq would be wrong, but it was already too late. Even though it was October of 2002, 6 months before the war in Iraq started, we were already bombing them more than average. So the bombing increased. I saw Army Ranger troop movements coming through my Air Force base, which they had never been there before. And the only reason I could say that they were there was to cross the border into Iraq and help soften up the air defenses. So I saw the war starting 6 months before it really did. And I pretty much knew it was inevitable, but I was against it from the start. And luckily, I wasn't stop-lost. I was allowed to leave the military on time, honorably discharged April of 2003, 3 weeks after the war started. And I started speaking out about it because I felt it was so wrong. I felt betrayed by the decisions that the administration made.
When Goodrich was discharged from the military, he joined a civilian fact-finding delegation to Iraq, a place he had managed to avoid while in the Air Force. He says he felt compelled to go there and see firsthand the war's effect on the country. What he found, he says, was devastating. No reconstruction had been done in the areas of Baghdad that he visited, and everywhere he went, he heard stories that he'll never forget.
Being a former member of the military and going through Baghdad, I kept asking myself, what happened here? Like, what did I help to do? Because even across the street from my hotel room, I walked out onto the balcony of my fifth floor hotel room, and across the street was a building that was just leveled. It used to be a telecommunications center. One of the stories that's going to stay with me for the rest of my life is that of Vivian Salam Mati. She told us of how the bombs were dropping near her house in Baghdad, and her husband made the decision to pack up the kids in the family car and take off to go to their friend's house in a safer neighborhood. So they're driving, and they came around a corner, and the troops were spraying gunfire everywhere, and the car was demolished, and Vivian's husband and three young children were killed, and she was the only one that managed to escape. I was just having to look into her eyes, her tear-stained face, and it's something that'll stay with me for the rest of my life.
When Goodrich returned to the U.S., he co-founded a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War, which began with 9 members and is now over 150 strong. Sean O'Neill lived in a middle-class home in Menlo Park, California. When his high school classmates headed off to college, O'Neill joined the Marines. After basic training, he took part in the invasion of Iraq in March 2003. He describes the experience as strange and anticlimactic.
That's really what it was. It was like, I can't believe what we just did. It's like a kid who stole a car and is like driving around town. Like, I can't believe I got away with this, you know, and then to get away with it. Is what it was. I really felt like this guilty pleasure of like, I can't believe we just pulled off like the biggest crime in the world or whatever, and we're getting away with it, you know? I mean, it was like really like this exhilarating feeling, you know? And what makes this even the more surreal is we had satellite phones because I had an embedded reporter on my vehicle. So like 3 hours into the invasion, I call my mom. It's like 11 in California at night. And I'm like, Mom, you won't believe what we just did. You know, we just invaded another country. And that, I think, surreal. It's completely, yeah. Unbelievably, just fantastic. Just, it's like, it blows your mind. It's like, you have nothing to compare it to before, really, what you're doing. It's like, you have gone your whole life with all these rules and structures, and everything has rules. And there is a structure to everything, and then just complete chaos, complete pandemonium, and you, to a certain extent, can do whatever you want. I mean, within the given guidelines. I mean, like, laws are gone, killing's okay, you can drive over whatever, blow anything up. I mean, it's insanity.
It was, like you said, it was just surreal. Like, at one point, we just got off our vehicles, and we're just, like, looking around, you know, there's no bombs dropping on us or anything like that, and it's just, like, dead quiet.
Sean Scharf served with O'Neill in the Marines.
And there was times when we first crossed over that, you know, we're rolling along in a big line of vehicles across the desert, and people were calling out, like, what's that over there? Look off to your, like, you know, 11 o'clock or something, like, traverse over there. And people would all look and, like, what is that? You know, tell me what that is. And it's like, it's a farmer with sheep. And we're just like, we'll just go around them. And they just, like, everyone's like, what do we do? What do we do? And, you know, we're just, like, rolling as it comes, you know, it's just like, we expected and we were told that there was going to be tanks on that border waiting for us. And as we drove by the burning tanks that have already been hit before we went over, it's just like, well, okay, what's next? Next was farmers with nothing but their sheep.
The soldiers in O'Neill's unit took a lot of fire over the months. Many were killed.
Zier Suarez, Sergeant Cook, Washalana. I knew a guy named, a staff sergeant named Molina Batista who had helped me out. A guy named Duraf, that's 5. My good friend Bowman, that's 6. So 6 people.
O'Neill remembers the first person from his unit who was killed. Jesus Suarez, who was born in Mexico and lived in Escondido, California. Suarez's father, Fernando, struggled to find out how his son had died after initially being told Jesus had come under enemy fire. O'Neill was there when Jesus was fatally wounded by an unexploded U.S. cluster bomb.
We were, I believe, just south of Nazaria, and we'd pulled off on the side of the road and set up into our defensive positions. And we, for some reason, sent scouts out. For whatever reason, no one was told that an artillery battery had just used cluster bombs in the area. And these bombs, if you're not familiar with them, have an incredibly high dud rate, which means that, you know, I think there's something like 50 bomblets in an area then that don't explode. It's a minefield for all intents and purposes, and they were not told. These guys just walked out into the field, and he stepped on it, and it blew his leg apart. He was pulled back to the medical vehicle, and they tried to call a medevac, and the medevac was broken down. This had also not been forwarded to hire. So the helicopter for our area was not working, so we had to try to get a hold of people in another area. And that took forever, too. And eventually, they just made the decision that they're just going to drive him to the nearest airfield. And that was, I think, like 60 miles away or something. Long story short, he sat on the road for about 2.5 or 3 hours waiting for a helicopter that wouldn't come. They drove him to the airfield, put him on a helicopter, and as he was flying to the nearest field hospital, he bled out and died because we didn't have a helicopter and he had to wait like 3 hours.
When he came back from Iraq, O'Neill felt the celebration of the troops by the American public glossed over what he calls the reality of war.
Glossed, you know, people like Jesus dying, glossed over the fact that, you know, villages got bombed into submission for no good reason. You know, overwhelming use of firepower sounds great, but, you know, it has its limits, you know, and sometimes people cross that line. Six guys, you know, in a mud hut, and we call in, like, a jet fighter to drop a bomb, artillery, mortars, rockets, helicopters, all this stuff coming in on, like, six guys. It's like, man, you know, we didn't know if the little compound, the villas they were in, had anyone in it.
For every veteran like Sean O'Neill who publicly opposes the war in Iraq, thousands of others are silently deserting. Still other soldiers say they object to the war, but feel it's their duty to remain loyal to the military. For Making Contact, I'm Sarah Olson.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Jeff Patterson. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by generous gifts from people in the community. We are committed to providing a unique forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have ideas for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or CD copy of program number 2605, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Pauline Bartolone, associate producer, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, outreach coordinator, Tom Evans, development associate, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor, and I'm your host and associate producer, Justin Beck.